As many of you know, the Planning Committee for the last number of years have been taking portions of our mission statement and focusing on them as ways in which we can inspire ourselves and prepare ourselves for the coming year. And this year, as you see, we have taken the phrase serve and lead, and I must confess it did not take our group long to recognize that we had plenty of alumni out there who are in that capacity and could speak to that, but we focused very quickly on John Stalwart, and we look forward to his presentations this morning, hopefully in a way that both inspires each of us in our own roles of leaders, but also to prepare other people to lead and serve as well. So I invite Kirk Schisler to come and introduce John.
My friendship with fellow classmate Dr. John Stalwart began in 1979 while I was a sophomore in EMU's Washington Study Service Year program, known affectionately by those of us in that era as WISE. And there was a moment that year, and I forget whether it was the fall of 78, John, or the spring of 79, when John stopped by to pay a visit to the current students in the house there on South Dakota Avenue. And that encounter 36 years ago led to a deep and abiding friendship that continues to this day and also includes John's spouse, Melonica, who is here with us this morning, also an alum from the class of 1981. There's another alum in the family, Emma. Many of you know Emma Stalwart, an environmental studies major, graduated in 2011, and pictured there, and then also their daughter, Clara, who is a rising junior in high school. I think it's fair to say that one of the most formative elements in our experience during the late 70s in EMU's Washington Study Service Year program was the encounter we had with Robert Greenleaf, the writings of Robert Greenleaf, specializing and emphasizing servant leadership, and parlayed to us through our mentors, Nelson Good and Arden Shank. We learned in that environment, in those teachings, the possibility that, in fact, servanthood and leadership could be combined into an effective modality that was actually a practical way to foster change and to foster healthy and sustaining communities around the world. We are fortunate today to have one with us who has delved deeply and applied the serving leading motif as an entrepreneur, CEO, prolific writer, and leadership mentor. John is founder and president of Serving Ventures, based in his beloved city of Pittsburgh. He is also the founder of Pittsburgh Urban Leadership Service Experience, known as PULSE, not PLUS as it's indicated in your program, but PULSE. Now in its 21st year of service, this organization has brought in and trained and mobilized more than 150 volunteers, many of whom have been alumni, or alumni of EMU, and has contributed countlessly to the improvement of life among more than 100 nonprofit organizations in the Pittsburgh area. John has his Bachelor of Science in Social Work from EMU, his Master's in Theological Studies at AMBS in Elkhart, and a Doctor of Ministry from Eastern Baptist Theological Seminary, now Palmer Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Won't you please join me in welcoming one of our own, Dr. John Stalwart.
I was waiting for the picture to disappear. Thank you for removing it. Because I wouldn't have any of your attention whatsoever for the rest of the time, and I would be blushing continuously. I can't adequately put in words the joy it is to be here 33 years after graduation from this institution to share briefly with you this morning around the themes of leading and serving. Thank you very much, Kirk, for the reminiscence of my longest line friendship. Many wonderful times, Lauren leaned over and said, he's not going to say everything he knows about you, is he, John? And I said, dear Lord, I hope not. Point of fact, I have dear friendships around this room, and I'm so grateful for the opportunity to share out of the years that I've spent largely serving outside the general framework of the Mennonite Church, while always maintaining very close ties. I have to digress a couple of times, and I will digress increasingly frequently as we proceed, and give myself freedom to do that as we interact. But Lauren told a little story about the first president of this institution, and in his gloss of that story, he indicated that maybe he thought there was wisdom being expressed in Brother Shetler's decision not to take the presidency of this school. I heard it. I doubt that that's how the story was written that Lauren took as his source material. And I was sitting over there 11 years ago in the spring, part of Mennonite Education Agency's board, when Lauren was being installed, or what do we do to college presidents? I know we install pastors and we install software, but we were going to do something that day, and everybody was about to robe up, and Lauren had already dismissed himself to get ready, and there were some remaining issues that the board of the MEA was working on, and so we tarried. And just before it was time for the rest of us to grab our robes and go and join the ceremonies, Lauren popped back in the room, robe thrown over his shoulder, interrupting our meeting, and said, excuse me, but is it too late for me to back out? And it was in that moment that I had further underscoring evidence of what I already was quite strongly suspicious of, and that is that this man is completely sane. 11 years ago. What? Oh, he was sane 11 years ago. Fair enough. I have no comment or data. One other comment, listening to the singing and reflecting on what you did for us this morning, Ken, in your theme of spirit and listening. A couple of years ago, I made the decision for a couple of strategic purposes to open up some pockets in my calendar to serve executive leaders, entrepreneurs, business owners, nonprofit chiefs inside my family, the Mennonite Church. My work had gone entirely to the world, and I didn't have much opportunity to do what I do with Mennonites. And so I began to do some work in Holmes County, Ohio, with owners and executives there, and in Lancaster, PA, primarily in Lancaster, so that I would have a monthly reason to see my mother, who is at Landis Holmes in her 90th year. And what I discovered, and I'll concentrate specifically on Holmes County for a second, what I discovered in working with the Beachy Amish community, especially where I have more clients who run $100 million companies than you can shake a stick at, is that these Beachy Amish leaders, many of them are also pastors, running beautiful businesses with excellence and values and integrity and love and discipline and focus and results, and an eye to the good of the world, all blended together as though there never was anything like dualism on the planet, were from a cappella traditions. And I was there at something called Boost a couple of years ago. Rosedale Mennonite Mission does an annual event for business as mission for the business leaders across the conservative Anabaptist community who are invested in their business lives but care about shalom in the world, care about truth and beauty and justice and goodness and human flourishing. And I was there speaking, and they brought in an a cappella group to sing. And it was like this morning. And I'll tell you what I heard and what I commented on. They were all rooted in the deep a cappella upbringings of their congregational life, able to listen. I was not hearing a group of people who were able to sing. That is a mistake if we think that what makes a sense of the coming of the Spirit is that everybody knows how to sing. I can fill a room with great singers, and the Spirit would not be present. What makes such a profound experience is when you are in a room of great singers who can listen. Because what they're doing is they are moving away from their own voice and being conscious of the space between voices so that the voices come together. I'm sure there is a technical understanding of this, but I've paid attention to it my whole life. And some people sing in such a way that is technically perfect, but their voice is just going to ricochet off any other voice and never join it. And others are aware of the space between because they're listening, and they put their voice with other voices. And that's where, among other places, the Spirit of God reigns. And I wondered, are these Beachy Amish business leaders so extraordinary at work because they've learned to listen in their a cappella traditions? Invariably, when I'm working with an executive team in a global company, and they're stuck. Yeah, and yes, this is an entire digression. I shall get to my remarks this morning, but it's not a digression at all. I'm moving with what Ken did this morning. Invariably, when I'm working with an executive team in a global company and they're stuck, and there's 12 chiefs sitting in the room and they're sideways, something didn't work, the plan failed, they already have what they need in that room for their breakthrough. I've been toying around with the idea that another source of revelation in the universe that there is a God is the organization, because I have yet to be in one that has not already been provided what it needs to flourish. And what usually is at fault is not that they're lacking anything and that some hotshot ought to come in and tell them something they don't know. And I'm not that kind of person. I don't know how to tell people stuff that they're not smart enough to know. It isn't how I work. Usually what's wrong in an organization is that that which has already been provided has not been noticed. And often my interventions as a coach and a trainer in an executive team sounds like this. Bob, did you hear what Shirley just said? Huh? Shirley, say it again. And so I've just been enjoying what we've been doing this morning as a gathering of people, paying attention to the Spirit, your remarks on listening, and reflecting on just how powerful this is. At the end of the day, our results in the world, and I'm terribly interested in fruitfulness and performance and results, is the product of our peopleness. At the end of the day, it's not a product of superior strategic plans or sufficient capitalization or good market analysis. All of which matters, all of which matters, and on and on and on. At the end of the day, the failure of our capacity to move from conceiving of what it is we want to do in the world that will make a difference and then having it actually work rests in the people space, which is the treasure of the universe, and begins with our capacity to learn how to be with one another and honor one another and pay attention to one another and learn from one another, and listen. So this has been deeply enriching to me, and thank you for those of you who have given leadership to the worship as we've begun. It was, as Kirk said, 37 years ago when I became an accidental student at Eastern Mennonite University and did so by transferring from Millersville University, where I had spent my freshman year, into the Washington Study Service Year Program in 1977. I was in the second year of WSSE. Kirk was in year three. And indeed, it was in the fall of Kirk's year that I made a visit and our friendship began. I was at Millersville my freshman year, and I was deeply dissatisfied. I wasn't getting what I needed there at all. The fact that I was at Millersville had nothing to do with a disinterest in Mennonite education. Quite to the contrary, I had been through quite a lot of it, and I loved it. At Lancaster Mennonite High School, I was arguably the most Anabaptist history and theology read student in that school. I stuck beside the Old Order River Brethren Anabaptist history and theology teacher Myron Dietz like glue, and took everything that I could take. I lived in the dormitory across the hall from then agricultural teacher Dick Thomas, who got a little extra dough, I think, by living in the dorm. And I would go over into Dick's room and we would talk endlessly about these things. It was Myron Dietz who, in my sophomore year, gave me The Politics of Jesus, written by John Howard Yoder. And yes, I'm not that far off the map of the Mennonite Church to be unaware of what goes on, and right up to the Christian Century article I just read within the last week about John. And I knew the first time I met John Howard Yoder, somewhere around my 19th birthday, that he wasn't an integrated human being. Little did we know, to our great horror and pain and the continuing work of the denomination, how much damage was there. But his book did me good, and I devoured it, The Politics of Jesus in my left hand and the Merriam-Webster dictionary in my right hand, the summer of my sophomore year, and thought my head was going to explode. Prior to that, I had gone to Crable Mennonite School, where the extremely strict and entirely black-clad Bishop Russell Baer was principal, and I learned Mennonite history from Russell. Russell became like a father to me to the very end of his life and was dear. So as I say, being at Millersville University was not a disinterest in all things Mennonite. Rather, it was not misguided. It was an unworked out idea that it was time for application. And first grade through 12th grade, completely immersed inside the identity of the Mennonite community and with a thoroughgoing intentionality on my part around Anabaptist studies, that I should figure out how to talk about these things and apply these things in the world. And what I didn't know and I understand now is that it's in my wiring. I have an academic capacity, but I want to build stuff. I want to make things. I want to see what happens when you push on this end, on the other end. And so I needed to get out into the world, and that's why I went to Millersville. And I didn't enjoy it at all. And at the end of my Millersville year, I heard about WSSE, and I knew Nelson Good from Hammer Creek, where I had started my life. The Good brothers were all part of the church where I'd grown up, and I flew down to Washington after they had selected the group that was going to be in the fall of 1977, typical of an ADD person with a procrastination problem. I went late and spent some time with Nelson, and I'm not sure what happened, but I got in, and it was life-changing for me. During that year, as Kirk said, we read a book that was published that year by Robert Greenleaf. That book was called Servant Leadership, but it was the subtitle, that got me really interested. A journey into the nature of legitimate power and greatness. Did you remember that, Kirk? You do now. Servant leadership. Now, that sounds very resonant with the Anabaptist themes I'd spent my short life unpacking. But there was something called legitimate power that I had never heard of, I assure you. And legitimate greatness. And that we were being called into a journey into those things was not taught to me by my mother, who was more afraid of Hochmut than anything. High-mindedness. Called into legitimate power, Anabaptists, the quiet in the land, we were to be faithful witnesses to the Lamb who was slain. Can I get an amen? An amen. And by witness, I do mean martyr. And I do. I'm not making fun. Quite to the contrary. And wasn't one of our chief characteristics our innocence? Really? Wasn't it? Victims who quietly and lovingly suffer at the hands of the warring world do not journey toward power and greatness. I'm telling you how I encountered this in 1977. I could have assured you of these facts. And they never call such a journey, the journey into power and greatness, legitimate. Indeed, our innocence was one of the cool aspects of our peoplehood. Not having power, we had deniability. Other actors had power, did stuff with their power, which we critiqued, to be sure. And they were guilty of the consequences, both the ones that they intended as well as the ones that they did not intend. Nelson Good and Robert Greenleaf gave me a language and an orientation for what became the pursuits of my lifetime. The entrepreneur I became, for example, was made possible by their thinking. My deep love and care for leaders and risk takers grew out of what happened to me that year in WISI. Rather than valorizing the not taking of action and the critiquing of the actors, I came to admire people who try to make things better. People who take action, who take risks, and who accept responsibilities for consequences. And admiring such people, I have dedicated my lifetime to helping them to learn and get better, and especially to grow as people of humility when they grow as people who exercise their power effectually. Can we play around for a little bit here for just a minute? Let's. I'm going to ask a couple of questions, and let's not be nervous. There are no right answers, wrong answers here. This isn't a trap. Everyone, please raise your hand. Keep your hand up if you agree with what I'm about to say. Power is good. I see people waving at me. I'm waving back. All right. Okay, let's do it again. Everybody, hands up. Keep your hands up if you agree with what I'm about to say. Power is bad. Let's talk a little bit. If I'm sitting in your shoes, I want to make some qualifications right about now about why my hand was up. So just let's listen to each other. Stand up, but no speeches, just a comment. What were you thinking about when your hand went like this or like this or it went down on either of these questions that you needed to say in addition to just this? Stand up and say something and watch who else is up. Power's neither good nor bad is a comment.
It depends.
It depends. Depends on what you do with it. Misuse of power is bad.
God is all powerful.
God is all-powerful. And there's no "it depends" on that, is there? Power corrupts. Everything corrupts, by the way. Just saying. Anybody else? Power, did you say change? Power can be used for lots of great change. Thank you. You know, there's nothing uglier than someone who's really strong who plays victim. It's very damaging. Or someone who is very big who still feels very small. So accountability and responsibility for our power matters a lot, and the ability to reckon with it and take the feedback we need to take and own the implications and the learning we need to go through. We cannot talk about leadership or servanthood, which we're going to do in this session and the next, without hauling out of our soul our wrestling match with power. And I think that it may be true that a people brutalized by the systems of power of the world, as we were, and I'm not saying you were, but we were, we carry in the psyche of our peoplehood a memory of being on the underside of the misuse of power. We, as faithful witnesses to the Lamb slain, I don't think that a people brutalized by the power systems of the world simply and in a generation or three works it all through. And in some ways, I think that we're very much about the business of continuing to sort out how to become people who stand up, bear witness, bear light, shine, move, have impact, bear fruit, yes, get results while maintaining humility and an irenicness, a commitment to the good. We get caught in the dichotomy of our fear of power and the fact that actually we exercise it all the time. We exercise it all the time. If I asked you, keep your hand up if you agree with the statement, muscle is good, you'd go about the exercise a little differently. And I think you'd probably say, well, yeah. Here's my answer. Power's good. Period. The use of it is everything. And if God is all power and all authority, at the end of the day, we can't do this on the question of is power good. But we are very torn on this subject. And I think legitimately so. Very legitimately so, we're very torn. And we have to square ourselves up with the fact that there is power and it is good. I'm telling you what I believe. You can set this aside. I'm just telling you what I believe, that there is power, it is good, and we exercise it. How are we going to find the courage to become accountable and effectual in ways such that our power moves with the grain of Christ's beloved and peaceful kingdom? So that we don't, as one of the people here said, become passive-aggressive and misuse power in lots of denying ways. Nelson Good said to us when we were in Washington, and this may have come from Greenleaf. I need to reread Greenleaf. I don't know if this is Nelson or Greenleaf. That a steward of a better world always has three choices when confronted by the violence and degradation of a broken human system or institution. We have more than one hand we can choose to play when we see something in the world other than the world as it is meant to be under the sovereign reign of Christ's kingdom of shalom. Talking now about the action takers, we who prayerfully and with great trepidation say, use my life for impacts that are good, have three choices. First of all, we can choose to tear an institution down if we feel it is beyond redeemability or doesn't belong on the face of the earth. There are times, Nelson said, when there is no redemption for an institution, and it must be picketed, demonstrated against, lobbied against, and if possible, wiped off the face of the earth. Incidentally, I think, a disproportionate number of Mennonite friends who prefer option number one as that avenue for the expression of their life's energy. That was not a critical comment. That was an observation. Some things need to be opposed and stopped. Secondly, we can choose to try and fix the thing up a little bit, renovate it, redeem it, so that it does less harm in the future and more good. There are times, Nelson said, when we should roll up our sleeves and accept the soiling that comes from trying to restore and improve an institution that has gone astray and that is far from what it was meant to be. I live in a Presbyterian city, and interestingly, in my observation, a disproportionate number of my Presbyterian friends like this option. All things redeemed, they say. And these friends can imagine the renewal of the earth, including the renewal of institutions that I see as hopelessly bound up in the limited structures of a violent world, structures that will cease to exist when the coming reign of Christ is fulfilled. But I have Presbyterian friends who are ready to crawl down into the engine case of just about anything to try to make it better. It's not a criticism. It's an observation. Third, we can choose to invent what simply does not exist. We have the things that we think that thing ought to stop. We ought to just fold that institution into a box and make it go away. People in the world would be better. Secondly, I know what it used to be and what it was meant to be, and let's get it back there. Third, that which is needed in terms of the ordering of people around a cause, the building of an organization, an institution, doesn't exist. There's a space, there's a gap in the system. We can imagine through the lens of the peaceable kingdom ways of being human, of nurturing relationships, of contributing value and advancing shalom, that simply have not yet been thought up yet. We can become innovators of the world as it shall be, building, inventing, designing, pilot testing, and creating goods and services and processes and pathways and solutions that bring forth truth, beauty, justice, goodness, human flourishing. In a word, shalom. I'll give you an example of that. If you stopped 10,000 Americans strolling down random city streets in 1950 and asked them, is there ever a situation in which an offender caught in the act of a crime would more profitably be restored to society by an opportunity to hear directly from a victim about what they did and how it had personal impacts? I wouldn't be surprised that in that random survey, you'd have gotten 100% no. That's what the court system does. I was walking down the street in Pittsburgh about a decade ago, and I passed two cops. And they were talking about restorative justice eloquently. That's an innovation. Now, it didn't come out of nowhere. It came straight out of what Scripture and the activity of God in history speaks to, pressed through the particular historical capability of the Mennonite Church, pilot tested in Ontario and Fresno and a few other places, and bit by bit, significantly served by this institution and many others, driven down into the soil so that a couple of cops walking down the street, having no idea of the genesis of this capability, are talking about restorative justice. That's the third option, Nelson said. There are ways of being human that reflect the very nature of God's intent for us that do not exist. And what do we need to do? We need to build capabilities for that. And what are those capabilities? Those capabilities generally are organizing activities that become organizations to hold those activities. Nonprofits, businesses, NGOs that bring into existence a way of being human that open up the territory and the ground for kingdom reality, the world as it is meant to be. That's our third choice. Now, I would argue, and I'm not going to make this argument today, it isn't my primary point. I'm going to walk us into organizational leadership. But I would argue that the institution of the church is designed primarily to be the innovator, the pilot tester, that place on earth where the world as it is supposed to be should be invented, shown, proven, tested, demonstrated, grown, and then giving it away to a watching world. Another book by John Yoder that made a lot of sense to me when he wrote Body Politics. So truth in advertising, I'm very partial to this third way. More truth in advertising. Whenever we choose this third way, we become guilty. This is the time to grow up part of our life. We become guilty of the harms that we will inevitably do. We lose deniability and we lose innocence. We've left the bleachers of clean-handed critique, and we choose this third way of engagement as we join actors, fallible actors. Let me describe how that works, and then I'm going to tell you a few stories. Whenever we choose this third way of engagement, we become admitted and intentional stewards of our power. We better would, or we create really sick institutions. We become immensely, therefore, interested in Robert Greenleaf's subtitle,
the journey into the nature of legitimate power, because we want to journey into the legitimate power, and we don't want to become the very thing that we're trying to overcome. We endeavor to get things done. After all, and getting things done involves our imagination. We picture something, the making of plans, which so easily go awry. When we endeavor to get things done, we realize that we have to gather and spend resources so that we can create stuff that needs to be created. And we go about the task of building, inventing, making things the world needs. And when we do that, there are always wastes, miscuts, errors, slips. We hire people, and no matter how good we are at it, we must inevitably fire some. We make awful mistakes. And there's always a reckoning that we must face. I call this truth in advertising. I don't have a hard time understanding why people are reluctant to move from the bleachers into accountability and ownership for a cause, because there's a great deal of pain and humiliation and damage to pride and days when we just have our breath taken away because it turned out so differently than we pictured it. I know that you know what I'm talking about. Earlier, I said that I've come to admire people who try to make things better, taking action, taking risks, accepting responsibility for consequences, committing to learn and to get better, growing in humility. As actors, as inventors of new things, there is always a reckoning, and the balance sheet is always mixed. Some things came out good, some didn't, because we erred and there were harms. How can a people of peace, historic victims of the power wielders and the harm doers, say, "I did it too"? It is specifically those actors, those risk takers and stewards of power, those who have grown in humility that I have come to admire. It's the leaders who learn how to handle the truth with humility that I admire, the leaders who get stuff done, who admit their harms and fix them, and who pick themselves back up, not learning the lesson of, "I'm not sticking my neck out again," but learning the lesson of, "I'm not all I thought I was. When I go back out and try again, let me listen better and let me learn." People like that put me over the moon. I live for them. I serve a Chinese toy maker. What do you think of Chinese toy makers? Just curious. T.S. Wong is the largest toy manufacturer in China. And let me tell you, it takes an awful lot of little tiny extruded plastic products to make $1 billion. Mr. Wong sat down with his wife 35 years ago, young engineer, and said to his wife, "I've made a decision. I'm going to run this company according to my convictions." Mr. Wong was a Christian, a reader of the Sermon on the Mount and of the rest of the Gospels and the Epistles. He said, I'm going to do this according to what's right. I'm going to treat people right. I'm going to treat quality right. I'm going to tell the truth." And then he said to her, "I'm sorry, we're going to be poor." Because in a Chinese business culture, you do what works, you don't do what's right. And so he set off on his project of becoming an action taker, an owner of consequences with a vision for shalom. His organization was organized legally as a for-profit. Other organizations are organized as nonprofits. Nonprofits aren't the ones that do good, and for-profits the ones that do bad. Bad nonprofits do bad, good nonprofits do good, bad for-profits do bad, and good for-profits do good. It was simply a legal structure that allowed him to pull capital together in ways and get certain things done that he would not have been able to do otherwise. And Jetta Corporation was founded, and away he went. And he experimented. He learned about the liquid labor pool in China. We have no idea how liquid Chinese labor is. At the start of the new working season, after holidays, whoever shows up back on your campus shows up back on your campus. Industry tends to be on campuses. People go back to their provinces to live and come back to your campus to do the work that you have them do. And he came to the conclusion that the business he was in was the business of growing the citizenry of a future China. So he made a mission decision. He got very clear on what the mission of his organization was, and we have to do that. If we don't know what our mission is, and if we drift left and right and grab at the brass ring there and the brass ring there, nobody knows who we are. And we hit the marketplace like a ice cutter hitting the ice flow broadside. And we get no mind space. And we don't get to attract people to come to us because they don't know what we are. He got very clear that he's in the people growing space. And that given the fact that a young Chinese worker was not going to spend a career extruding small plastic objects onto vast conveyor belts, but rather that a young Chinese worker was there for a purpose, that purpose being to work for 3 to 5 years to accumulate capital so they could go back to their province and start their life, buy property, buy a business, have a family. He said, I've got something like a university here. And what kind of a Chinese human being will I produce in the 3 to 5 years I have them? He got that clear, and he went to work. And by the way, you would be thrilled. I was going to say amazed. You would be thrilled at how many business owners around the world think like Mr. Wang. They don't make the press. There are more of him than the bad ones. I don't know if you believe that, but nobody's telling you it's true, so I am. So, he said, what do we need to do? So he instituted a healthcare system inside Jetta Corporation, 40,000 employees. He said, a future Chinese worker needs to understand what it's like to be treated like a human being with dignity. He put commissaries in, bringing chefs in from every province. A young Chinese worker ought to be able to walk into the commissary morning, noon, and evening, and get the finest food cooked from their home community and all they want so that they have a wonderful time with food. He put in a library area on each of his campuses on the ground floor, open ground floor, underneath the dormitories, where his people kept track of the home provinces and the hometowns of his employees. And every day they changed out the newspapers so that his employees could find home province, hometown, daily newspaper, every page displayed so they could stay in touch with their family. He made sure that every one of his workers could finish education. He taught entrepreneurship. He taught financial management, saving, and on and on. Because he said, I'm building a human being here. And my strategy is toys. People like this put me over the moon. About 12 years ago, he said, you know, the Chinese toy industry is so horrible. And that was before the great disaster that ruined fortunes because of crap in toys and American buyers who weren't paying attention. Mr. Wang said, we got to do something about the fact that Chinese toy makers destroy their people. And so he created something he called Toy Christian Fellowship. They've changed the name, but it was to be the good housekeeping seal of Chinese toy making. And by this point, he was in the middle of the pack. Much to his amazement, yes, he lost business. Yes, he lost deals. But he also won trust. People realized in the U.S., manufacturers in the U.S. who were paying attention realized, you know, we don't get junk back. And he keeps his word. And when he went to inspect, they said, we like the way the people are treated here. And the workings of the marketplace positioned him and situated him. And so he created this good housekeeping seal. And he said, if you want to learn how to run a company according to values, I'll teach you. And if you treat your people right, treat the earth right, he instituted environmental standards that are still probably 40 years ahead of China. And treat integrity right. If you demonstrate to me that you live those values in your company, we'll give you the good housekeeping seal of this association. And if you don't know how to do it, we'll teach you, but we will inspect. Nobody signed up to join his good housekeeping seal vision. And then the toy crisis hit. And Western buyers lost their shirts and were ashamed, some of them genuinely. Others realized that they had customers who were angry and they ought to listen to them, whether or not they were ashamed. But the industry began to say, what is going on in Chinese toy making? And the word spread rapidly, Jetta doesn't do that junk. And his company went to the top of his space. 3 years ago, the Chinese government was dealing with a CEO in another large manufacturing company in China that had particular problems with suicide. Chinese government can handle a certain amount of it. People go to work and kill themselves. That's the number one place in China where you commit suicide because you can't stand your life there. They build Chinese manufacturing facilities with nets above the ground floor in anticipation of the jumpers. This company crossed the line. Too many suicides. Just ponder that thought. It wasn't the right number. And the government was ashamed, and they ordered the CEO of that company to go to Guangzhou and spend time with Mr. Wang to try to learn how to run a company where people don't want to kill themselves. And I ask you, is Mr. Wang on the wall with you as an agent of the kingdom of God making toys? I also work with a briefer example, a Beachy Amish manufacturer in Sugar Creek. Mr. Bill Mullett has become a dear friend. Bill was a Beachy Amish pastor, Beachy Amish bishop later, and his day job was so that he could do what God called him to do, which is to be a pastor. And he had a contracting business. Bill Mullett and T.S. Wong founded their companies in the same year. One of my fantasies is to get people like this into the same room with each other. They'd never want to leave. The contracting business made money, supported Bill and his wife in their pastoral call, but you know, people who are having their house built want the contractor when they want the contractor. And fundamentally, Bill was a pastor, and he was clear on that. And he needed to be available to his congregation when the congregation needed him. His brother had a screen door business, which was a stinker that made no money. And Bill bought it. So he had a screen door business that he could do at night, and he had a contracting business that made money. And he and his wife prayed. And at the end of the prayer, and I want you to remember what I said about Mr. Wong, Bill said, we're selling the contracting business. I'm supposed to be a pastor. I'm really sorry, but we're going to be poor. And then he began to apply himself, caring for his people, doing the right thing, over-delivering quality to his customers, and a variety of things I'll talk about in the next hour. There's only one company in America that builds doors and windows that has received the Energy 5-Star Sustained Excellence Prize. Only one. The Sustained Excellence is above the 5 stars. Provia Windows and Doors in Sugar Creek has gotten it for the last 6 years straight. And you walk around their facilities and you see people who are delighted to do great work for people they trust and who go the extra mile and produce beauty like you would not believe. The company has passed $100 million in annual sales and continues to grow. Growing people, building beauty, serving the world in the private sector. Two stories of two leaders who began not the way we read about in business school. It began with a gut check, and they said, probably it isn't going to work, but I'm going to do it the right way. I have a final question for you, which we'll use to anchor out of this meeting. And we'll come right back to it when we come back. Who here knows what the Peter Principle is? Somebody. Stand up so we know it's going to be you talking. What's the Peter Principle? You don't have to get it exactly right. Yeah, Lawrence Peter wrote the book, The Peter Principle, in 1960, and he said people tend to get promoted to incompetence. And I've thought about this for years, and here's my conclusion. Lawrence Peter was descriptively right. He called it as he saw it. He was analytically wrong. People do not get promoted from competence to incompetence. People get promoted from one or another professional or skill excellence to leadership. And leadership isn't what they were good at. And we don't help people understand how the entire world has just changed because you did really well as a nurse. You get to be charge nurse. You got a new job. Now you have people showing up that you have responsibilities very specific to help them show up strong and love their work and want to get there and know what excellence looks like and do the right thing when you're around the other corner and give the second and the third mile because of things you're doing that deserve that second and third mile. We don't teach that. In a died and went to heaven scenario in every high school and college I serve, as well as in business schools, we do not teach it. We think the win is a body of skill sets that we take out into the marketplace and our people become the very best people in their field. And that's the extent of our vision for where we're going. And we don't take it one step further and say, what's going to happen to them if that happens? They're going to get promoted. They're going to have an idea. They're going to want to pull some money together. They're going to want to build something. They're going to want to figure out, and by the way, we do it in entrepreneurship as well. Great idea, plenty of capital, good strategic plan, good marketing plan. That's going to be a winner. I'll give $1 million to that deal. Oops. You're going to fry everybody who comes to work for you. That's my segue. When we come back, we're going to talk about what a leader actually is and has to do and get good at.